Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I just came back from a failed attempt to act in California, and like had this old 1990 Lincoln Town Car that I drove from Indiana to California, and it broke down outside of Amarillo, Texas, and I spent all my money that I had fixing it, and by the time I got to California, I had no money left, so I just turned around and went right back.
This week, we are very pleased to have the fine stage, TV, and film actor, Adam Driver. Serious Eaters have enjoyed his provocative, thoughtful performances on Girls, as well as in movies like Lincoln, Hungry Hearts, Midnight Special, Inside Llewyn Davis, and Star Wars, The Force Awakens. Something you may not know about Adam, he and his wife, actress Joanne Tucker, founded Arts in the Armed Forces, a nonprofit organization that performs monologues and music for military personnel and their families. Welcome to Special Sauce, Adam. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, please. So before we start, I have to hear about the meal Kenji cooked for you recently. You know, Kenji is, of course, our culinary wizard at Serious Eats. So how was it? Like, I need a truthful opinion.
Delicious. I wish I could say something kind of snarky, but I can't. I can't think of anything. It was delicious. It was fish tacos. I think
it was fish tacos.
The last thing he cooked for us.
He makes excellent fish tacos.
Yeah. Nothing compares to it since. I just had a fish tacos last night, actually.
Really?
They sucked.
And is it true? He told me this, that you had a bowl of cereal after the dinner of fish tacos while Kenji did the dishes.
That's probably true, yeah. Which is, I hope, wasn't an insult. I just eat a lot of food.
No, he didn't take it as an insult because I think he asked your wife and she said he does that frequently.
Yeah, all the time. Just eat a dinner and then eat a dinner after the dinner because it's usually not enough.
And does it matter what the second dinner is? Is it usually cereal?
I think, yeah, just whatever is in the house.
Got it. So cereal's easy.
Yeah, cereal's. Plus, I'm not a very good cook. That's something I've been working on this past couple months. But I like that Jerry Seinfeld thing that he says about cereal where you feel like you're eating and drinking at the same time. The multitasking of it, it's so easy, you know.
Got it.
I do little flourishes with the bowl.
You're like the espresso, you make the milk into designs.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I'm like, this time I'm opening the package.
So tell us about life at the Driver family table growing up.
Oh, that's a good question. Like, what was it like?
Yeah, like, what were you eating? Like, who was cooking?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so my mom would cook. My dad would not cook often. My stepdad. My parents split when I was, like, seven.
So right.
When I would visit my father, it was, like, you know, top ramen, you know, made of macaroni or spaghetti.
Right.
My mom would cook, like, a lot of steak. No bake cookies, which is not baking, but then she would make these things called peanut butter balls for Christmas that were really great. Her lasagna was really good. I can't remember if I remember I just said that. Hamburger cheese bake, a lot of hamburger cheese bake.
Hamburger cheese bake.
Yeah. She wasn't very good with steak, you know, which
Let me guess, she would burn it.
Yeah, she would overdo it, so it was very chewy.
Yeah.
So it was always like an athletic event, you know. but it was good, you know, because there was a lot of talking going on at the dinner table, a lot of dialogue.
That was part of the family table, too.
Yes.
Was very much, hey, how was your day? What's going on?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And just arguments. Not arguments is the best way to
heated discussions.
Yes, yeah. Pointed discussions, both good and bad. Not even...
Give me an example.
About Michael Jordan being the best basketball player, you know, is if that's true or not, which it was true.
There were so many heated discussions in my house that it was like Speaker's Corner at Hyde Park in London, you know. It's like people were just like always screaming at each other.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate about random, from egg commercials to, you know, anything random. We would have salt and pepper shakers. There was... anything was open for discussion.
Was there anyone trying to get the last word?
My stepdad, I think. Well, I think we were all trying to get the last word.
So you ended up in the Marines right after 9/11. You applied to Juilliard then, and you didn't get in, right?
Yeah.
And then you enlisted in the Marines. What motivated you to do that?
Well, mostly it was, well, a collection of things. I think mostly it was right after September 11th, and I felt like a lot of people at my age range at that time wanted to do something and be involved and were very kind of in, had an overwhelming sense of patriotism and, you know, anger. And then also I wasn't doing anything. I was working like three odd jobs at the time. I just came back from a failed attempt to act in California. I like had this old 1990 Lincoln Town Car that I drove from Indiana to California, and it broke down outside of Amarillo, Texas, and I spent all my money that I had fixing it, and by the time I got to California, I had no money left, so I just turned around and went right back.
Wait, you mean you didn't even have, you didn't have one meeting?
No, I feel like the in my in was like a professor who was at UCLA who somehow my uncle knew, and he was, and then I got there and I met him like as their last class was happening, and they were all going out to a bar to celebrate the last class, and I was 18 and couldn't go in the bar. I think I got carded and like you can't go in. So he's like, well, I'm going to go in this bar with my class. Do you want to wait outside? And I'm like, no, I'll wander the streets more. And that was my old, that was my connection to Hollywood. And I met, there was like an apartment. I can't even really describe. It was like an agency that helped find you an apartment. So you give them all their money and they helped find you an apartment.
Right.
They just took all my money and I never got an apartment.
So did you end up sleeping in the Lincoln Town Car?
I did. Yeah. I slept one night in the town car.
Oh, my God.
I slept in a youth hostel in Santa Monica. I didn't even make it to LA. Yeah, I just made it to Santa Monica. Then that was it. Then I had no more money. And then when my car broke down, I had to sleep in the car.
At least you had a town car. What if you had a VW?
Exactly.
You're a big dude.
Yeah, very, very tall. Very Sasquatch-ish.
Yeah. Sasquatch-ish.
But the back was all filled with my stuff, too. My parents would – I had to pay rent in the back room of the house, and they made me buy – my own like microwave and mini fridge, so like
so
to make it feel like an apartment.
All your belongings were in the back seat in the trunk, so you were fitting your 6'3" frame in the front seat.
Yeah, yes, with my mini fridge and my fucking.
So are your legs
microwave.
Sticking out the window?
No. I think
okay.
I fit. They're
okay.
Big cars.
Okay. Yeah, they are big cars. So you've often spoken about the profound effect the Marines had on you. Specifically, what did you learn about yourself there? And just as importantly, what did you learn about the Marines and the guys you serve with?
I would say the camaraderie of that unit, the team effort that it took. You can really see firsthand how much you have to rely on the people that are next to you. And just like your same thing with your equipment, your gear that you have, you have to test it to trust that it's going to work, you know, that you only know a gas mask is going to work until you're gassed. And
right.
Then you use it and you're like, oh, okay, I can breathe. I trust this piece of equipment. I mean, not to equate people to objects, I guess, but the kind of same principle applies to a platoon or a unit. You're constantly put in these stressful circumstances and you're tested. You're tested and the people that are around you are tested. And more often than not, they would kind of rise. Almost always rise to the occasion and protect you at their most vulnerable. You know, whether it be freezing cold in a boat in the ocean at 2 o'clock in the morning, or in a mountainside, like not wearing hardly any clothes because you know someone made a mistake and packed the wrong gear, or you're staying out for an extra day and you kind of everyone's huddling together just to stay warm.
Right.
You know, those relationships are put to a test. I think that that doesn't really equate to like a civilian, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A life and those relationships I wasn't expecting to be as powerful as they wound up being.
So,
I also didn't come from an environment where I was like very comfortable or enjoyed being around like a bunch of dudes being dudes, you know, like we're men and we play basketball and there's nothing wrong with that. I just wasn't, you know. And then you're with a platoon of, you know, alpha male guys and they're the bond between those people I wasn't expecting.
And you've talked about seeing many examples that you just mentioned of self-sacrifice and moral courage among mm-hmm. those people.
Yeah.
And that must have had a profound effect.
You would think that when your body is stressed that the self-preservation kicks in and suddenly that you're out for yourself. But when that's never been the case with my platoon. seemingly mundane example, I guess, we have to go on this long hike, you know, to be combat ready. And one of the hikes is like 26 miles in full gear.
It's a marathon.
It is. Yeah, yeah, basically. Some people, everyone has different body types. Some people are bigger, some people are smaller, and, you know, they can't haul, you know, 90 pounds for 26 miles or 26 plus miles. And so, you know, your feet blister over like mile 15 and you can't, and watching people disperse their gear among, you know, or people grabbing them and pushing them up the hill just so they complete it. That's a small example, but, you know, it was little things like that that were a daily occurrence. You know, people kind of checking in to make sure if someone, you know, lost a family member or was breaking up with a girlfriend. There was always kind of a circle of people making sure that everything was copacetic.
What was the most scary thing that ever happened to you when you were in training?
There is a thing called white phosphorus, which is this chemical that you train with. And artillery was firing white phosphorus over us. It's like very acidic. It burns through, heavy equipment. And artillery was firing over us. We were mortarmen. And the range for artillery is very far. So, and there's a thing called an FO, or forward observer, who's basically calling out the coordinates for the target, and then the artillery, because they can't see because they're firing at such great distances, rely on the forward observer to kind of give them the exact coordinates. And the one day artillery was, you know, it's training, so people are practicing and rehearsing just sometimes with live ammunition, and they fired white phosphorus on us accidentally on our platoon. Things like this happen in training. You know, people are, you know, figuring out their jobs, but sometimes it comes at a great cost. And then that day it was, a mistake. Someone got it wrong.
But you could have died.
We could have, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And we all ran, and it was very windy. But, you know, everything was fine. But that was the first time since joining the military, I think I was like a year in at that point, where something really, like, could have gone totally wrong in it. It was a big moment for me at the time.
Yeah. And you never got to deploy the way your friends did because you broke your sternum in a
mountain biking accident.
Right. And you've talked about that also had a profound effect on you, that the fact that your friends were going into harm's way and you didn't.
For sure. That bond I was talking about is a very real thing. And suddenly to be pulled away from it was not an easy thing to digest.
Did all those people come back?
They did. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know people come back in various forms.
People come back. Yeah. But then not everybody survived. But yeah. But they definitely came back from
that first deployment. Is there anything interesting to say about food in the Marines? Like, what'd you eat?
They had on base, it was like kind of powdered milk and, you know, always a meat, a starch, and a vegetable, and you couldn't go back for seconds. And it used to be an actual MOS, a military occupational specialty, and actually used to be a cook, used to be an actual job. But the military, as far as I was explained, is the least funded branch of the armed forces. And so they cut that MOS and folded people into.
So everyone had to take turns cooking.
No. They still had, I think they was hired civilians to be the cooks. So, but it's not like you would probably see in a movie of like, you know, the military cooks. They're civilian cooks. And they're always kind of an odd bunch of people. And the meals were not great. They did have these things called MREs, which is probably the most important thing to talk about, where this like chemical that you drop water in and it starts to heat up, and those were like a hot item, getting the right MREs.
MREs are meals ready to eat.
Right, of course, yeah. I can't remember what the hot MREs were that were everyone wanted to trade, you know, to get the right one. And then also had these little Tabasco sauce and salt and pepper, and you could make like little Tabasco bombs with these heaters, you know.
That's so awesome. And Tabasco bombs.
Yeah,
I like that.
And you would save the salt, you know, from the when you went on a long hikes, which we would call humps, because you would lose so much salt that often during the humps you would take the packages and just down it raw to give your body some salt again. The meals are a very important part of military life.
And did you really swap Could you swap MREs?
You could, or pieces of MREs. Like if you had like M&Ms and yours and someone else had Twix and, you know, you're not a Twix guy. You know, you could substitute those out. Yeah.
So you got out of the Marines after the biking accident.
Oh, I remember another random detail, which you probably edit out. Another rumor, and I don't know if this is true, that the also part of the MREs is it's supposed to like condense your bowel movements so that they were more succinct. That was also...
I love the idea, first of all. I'm going to forever walk away from this interview with succinct bowel movements.
Yeah, yeah. So whenever you're in the field, it just made things a lot cleaner. You know, it made it a more straightforward process. Yeah. I don't know if that's true. Maybe there's a way to Google that.
Are there things that you took away from the military that serve you well as an actor?
Completely. That working as a team and being able to trust everyone that is on your little unit or platoon is the biggest thing that I took away. And I feel like try to duplicate sometimes in a acting setting. I mean, it's impossible. The stakes are completely different, you know. But that the team nature of it, I really respond to. That's my favorite part of acting is the people that you get to work with, both in front of camera and behind the camera.
Which was your favorite part of being in the Marines?
Yeah, yeah.
The interactions and the bonds that you form.
Completely, which was unexpected. I didn't expect that was going to be my favorite part. I thought it was going to be, you know, firing guns and...
Yes, and I remember reading that you had your own fight club in high school, so you had a lot of aggression to work through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, probably most people from the... I mean, not to call out the Midwest, but or just young males.
I think it's 17-year-old testosterone-filled.
You don't know
human
what's happening
beings.
Inside your body. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just need to be pointed towards a field and told to run.
Yes. And you need to. Your aggression has to come out somehow.
Yeah.
There's a craft to being a Marine. Does that relate to the craft you've developed as an actor?
Well, you're definitely exposed to people that are your age. Around your age who are in very high-stakes situations and because of which behave maybe erratically, which is interesting for an actor to witness. I mean, mental toughness is a huge thing that can't be undervalued in the military. I mean, obviously, the Marine Corps, so much is made of, you know, the physical part of it, and that's a huge element.
And that's transferable.
Takes practice.
I mean... You talked about when you did the Martin Scorsese film Silence that you were constantly being dipped into super cold water.
Well, not constantly. The last couple days. Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. No, the more was the losing weight over a long period of time that took a level of insanity that I.
You lost 51 pounds.
51 pounds. Yeah.
And by the way, you're not fat. To start with.
No, yeah, yeah.
So
no.
Where did the 51 pounds come from?
At the time, I weighed more. I weighed like 206. But now I've had time off, so I haven't really been eating food as much and cooking, and it's not very good, so I don't eat as much.
We're going to fix that.
Right. But it just, you know, like you deprive your body of food and like try to trick it into thinking it's full, eating a lot of fiber, drinking a lot of coffee and seltzer water and things like that and run.
So how did you get from the Marines to acting? I know you ended up at the University of Indianapolis for a couple of years and then you reapplied to Juilliard, right?
Yeah. Well, as you said, I applied when I was a senior in high school, didn't get in and thought that, okay, then college isn't for me. So then, but when I got out, I had this sense that after facing the military, what civilian problems could I mean, that would be pretty easily manageable compared to what which is an illusion, but at the time, that's what I thought. So I knew that Juilliard was supposed to be the best school for acting, so I, of course, would just go to the best school to be an actor. And if it didn't work out, like, I knew how to survive in New York. Like, New York seems like it would be an easy place to navigate after the military.
And you got in.
And I got some
miracle.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the interesting things about you that I learned is this foundation that really does truly connect your experience in the armed forces to your acting, mm-hmm. which is the foundation that your wife and you run, AITAF, Arts in the Armed Forces.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. What motivated you to do it, and what preconceived notions were you aiming to debunk?
Yeah, there's a lot of answers there, too. I came to Juilliard really not knowing much about theater, but was interested in it. And really, if you don't know anything about theater, then suddenly going to, you know, the top school in my mind in the country for acting, you get like a crash course very quickly in all these great playwrights, Shakespeare, obviously, but also contemporary American playwrights. Like Sam Shepard, who just passed away recently, was a big influence on me. True West was, I thought, you know,
oh,
amazing play.
I saw the original production. It was awesome.
Oh, yeah, with Ed Harris?
Yes, yeah. Ed Harris, yeah.
Yeah, right. Mamet and, you know, Tony Kushner, all these incredible playwrights.
And you got to do Angels in America.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Did Angels in America at the Signature when mm-hmm. Jim Houghton was who also just recently passed away.
Was the artistic director.
Was the artistic director, yeah, of Signature, and he, my second year of Juilliard, became the head of the drama department at Juilliard.
Got it.
And I was noticing a change in myself coming, you know, back to that 17 or, I mean, at the time, I think I was 20 when I got out, or 21. Had all of these, you know, feelings about being in the military, you know, regret, guilt, you know, not going along and being exposed to these playwrights who were writing plays that had nothing to do with my military experience were somehow arming me with language in a way that I had never used before. We were talking earlier about that. My house was very filled with debate, but a lot of it wasn't really centered around explaining yourself or, you know, feelings or emotions. It wasn't like part of the dialogue.
Right. And it wasn't family therapy at your
dinner table. And it was also, which is not to,
Most family dinner tables are not therapy.
Right, right.
Except dysfunctional
it's
therapy.
Survival. Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the people in the military. I'd seen so many guys who were just so frustrated that they couldn't just articulate what their point was. And I thought that plays and doing, you know, knowing that plays and playwrights started from these military generals, Sophocles, Aeschylus, who wrote written these plays about military situations for a country that was at war at the time on, you know, six or seven fronts, and, you know, and how important that was to their community, and saw the theater and the military crossed over in a way, and wanted to share that with people that I was in the military with, who I thought could benefit from mm-hmm. seeing a play, and also just being told. And I reached out to different organizations, and they kept telling me that theater didn't fit a military demographic, that they would rather see, you know, some innocuous bullshit. I can't remember what it was. It was cheerleaders and things like that, but just kind of dumbed down entertainment because they couldn't handle something thought-provoking. And that made me upset, considering I know...
You knew that wasn't true for you.
Yeah, and the people that I served with, you know, it was a play. Like, we're talking about reading monologues, you know.
Right.
It's amazing how you take theater outside of New York and suddenly it's this weapon, you know.
Yeah.
And I always get incensed by the idea that a culture, you know, outside of New York won't be able to handle theater, you know, it doesn't go with their profile.
Right. So you said theater isn't just talking about feelings or people wearing tights.
Exactly. Actually, Jim Houghton helped us shape the structure of it would be to make it like you could travel easily with it. So we just picked really great speeches from contemporary American plays that had nothing to do with the military at all. We do no sets, no costumes, no lights, and just have great actors read it.
Wow.
Kind of out of context for a military audience. We keep all the house lights up. There's no production value, and people just get the connection right away.
That's so fascinating. You once also said that kind of thing would resonate with the military, that you either use the anger that's in us all or you stew in it. This was a constructive way to use the anger.
Sure, sure. And not that I'm all anger, but...
I'm just saying in general. I'm not saying it's your anger.
For sure. Being able to articulate a feeling is like a very powerful thing. Surprisingly underrated.
Yeah. I can't believe you've been sitting here and we haven't even gotten to any of the movies and all the great directors. So will you come back, Adam?
Sure. Yeah. Sure, I'll come back.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to have you back because there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us.
Thank you.
Adam Driver. Check out Adam and Logan Lucky. The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, and the new Star Wars movie. And log on to AITAF.org and make a donation. Adam and his wife will greatly appreciate it. So long, Sirius Eaters. We'll see you next time.